This is a recording from New Dominion Bookshop, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Prize-winning author Michael Malone has been called an American original. On Wednesday, May 27, 2009, Malone gave an audience at the New Dominion Bookshop a glimpse of his latest novel, The Four Corners of the Sky. Mr. Malone was introduced by Elizabeth McCullough of Writer House.
I want to introduce to you a man whom Robert Penn Warren once said showed narrative gift and a true eye for character and action. And I first came to know Michael Malone when he agreed to participate in an online forum that my husband and I run called Book Balloon. And I was so charmed by his gentlemanly manner and his generosity in sharing his talent with the members of our forum and his willingness to try new things. And so I'm very excited to be introducing him. I've got his very lengthy biography here, and I'm just going to select a few highlights. Many of you may know his 1986 novel Handling Sin, which was called a phenomenal, hilarious success, a heartwarming tour de force, and an immense, joyous novel, and was compared to work by Dickens, Cervantes, Twain, and even the Marx Brothers, which is very apt. And apparently you can't even get it. What did you say? It came in and it went right back out again. But it is still out there. He has won many awards. His short story, Red Clay, was awarded the Edgar in 1997. He has won the O. Henry Award. He has been on many Best Book of the Year lists. He's been published in very notable magazines, including Harper's, Playboy, Mamzelle, Psychology Today, and has contributed as a critic to the New York Times Book Review, The Nation, Newsday, and many other places. And he is also very well known as the Emmy Award-winning writer of One Life to Live. And apparently this was one of the most, you were in charge of some of the most popular storylines that the show has ever seen. So this is, you have a chance here to pepper this man with questions. I encourage you to do so. And I'll leave it to him to tell you more about Four Corners of the Sky, his lively book.
Yes, I was doing a reading at McIntyre's, a bookstore in Farrington Village, do you know, near Chapel Hill, beautiful place. And they had a big placard, and it said, Michael Malone, award-winning head writer of ABC's Days of Our Lives. And then in little print said, also, New York Times best-selling author of novels. Now, Days of Our Lives was not, I never worked on it, and it's not an ABC show either. So both would have been very upset by this. But I did write One Life to Live, and some of the stories that we created were very controversial. And it's interesting because I've been getting emails because they are redoing one of the famous stories we did about college date rape, and variously known as the Marty and Todd story or the Todd story. This character who was frat boy number one went on to become one of the huge stars of the show. And so they're redoing it, and they even brought back all the old people who had participated in this horrific event, who'd been in prison all these years, but hadn't changed that much, and were apparently up to their old shenanigans the minute they got back to their fraternity house in Landview. So, but I'm going to talk about, also wrote some novels, and it's particularly the novel, The Four Corners of the Sky. And it's wonderful to do it in a real bookstore. I've been on a book tour, so if I sound a little hoarse, this is like my 45th event. And many of them had been in Barnes and Nobles or Borders. And so you're in the middle of your reading, and then you hear the loudspeaker, Judy, go to customer services. Judy, go to customer services. And then you wonder, are there people at customer services that wonder where my reading is? But, they can't find it because it's back in the back in a long corridor that's stacked with cartons of books about vampires. You know? And there's two people who are very upset about some story on One Life to Live, sitting there saying, "How could you do that to Dorian?" And one person lying in the back, lying across about four seats, eating a magazine that you think really needs medical help. And so this is a pleasure to talk to people who clearly read. The Four Corners of the Sky, just to tell you very little bit about how it came to be, it began in a college tour for our daughter. My wife Maureen is here, who's a Renaissance scholar. It's very strange for me to have her here because I often talk about her, but I have to watch what I say. And Maggie, our daughter, to whom the book is dedicated, said, "Would you take me to Annapolis? I want to look at the Naval Academy, and I think I might like to apply." And she came and looked at this little silver airplane, and she was quite petite, and it sort of was like her size, little, and said, "You know, I'd like to be fast. I'd like to fly a combat jet." Oh. And her very liberal, progressive parents are going, "Let's go join the Navy, fly a combat." The only other time she ever so shocked us was when she called us from the college she did go to, Yale, and said, "You two better sit down, because I have something to tell you that's going to really upset you." And I thought she'd wrecked her car. And I won't tell you what Maureen thought that she'd done. But what she said was, "I've joined the sorority." And we were just deeply distressed. So that was the origin of the novel. And you see on the front the little girl who is in this classic landscape that I'll talk about in a minute, with this very modern plane and very modern shoes. And the origin of that image and of the foundation of the novel, I'm always saying every novel rests on the shoulders of the ones that go before it. It stands on them, and they hold it up. There's a novel of mine, The Last Noel, that is a love story, that you meet the two people when they're 7 years old. One is very disenfranchised, very impoverished, is African-American, is the child of the maid of the household. She is very privileged and very entitled, a young princess-like creature. When he climbs in through her window at Christmas, you will, somewhere in you, you may not be conscious of it, the meeting between Heathcliff and Kathy will be in your mind. And therefore, when the book comes to the conclusion it comes, which made so many people angry with me, "How could this happen to her?" And I said, "What else could happen to her? What? It's love story. It's Wuthering Heights. What happens to the heroine?" So, Handling Sin, which Dave mentioned, Elizabeth, is a novel that began when I woke Maureen up in the middle of the night and said, "I want to write the funniest book ever written." And she said, "Too bad for you. It's already been written, and it's Don Quixote." Now, only someone who spent her whole life reading The Faerie Queen and Paradise Lost would ever think Don Quixote was the funniest book ever. But what I did was to go to Don Quixote to find the journey and the path through that story. This is the most like Handling Sin of any of my novels, in that it is a journey, a comic journey that takes a very serious, responsible, practical heroine through a landscape physical. She goes from North Carolina to St. Louis to Miami to Havana. But the real journey she goes on is an emotional journey. What she has to do is let go of the sense of justice and rightness to accept forgiveness and tolerance, to forgive the past, to forgive the parents, to accept the clutter and mess of life, to step out of the solitude, of the safety of the four corners of the sky where she lives, going 1,200 miles an hour, to fall into life out of that. And in the novel, there is a big puzzle on the dining room table, and all the pieces are blue, so it's very hard to put together. And it takes them decades, the family. And they start with the four corners, because they're the easy ones to do. And slowly through the years, they put the pieces in. And when she finally meets, as her aunt says, where's the one for Annie? When she finally meets the one, the centerpiece goes into the puzzle. Now, I'm not saying that like Doris Day, a heroine, who has a perfectly good career and is absolutely successful, but it's all for naught, means nothing until she falls in love and marries Rock Hudson, not having noticed that he's gay.
That's
always a disappointment, yes. That this young woman has had a lot of battles fought for her by other women. They've gone before her. I just noticed just a few days ago, the military is finally going to give congressional medals, civilian medals, congressional medals to the women who flew those planes and moved those planes for the in World War II, who got those planes to where they could be flown into mission. And those women, when the war was over, they had to pay their own way home. They got no GI Bill. They got no veterans benefits. So there's one particular heroine of Annie's that she has her picture up on her wall that was a British, Amy Johnson, flew the first flight to Australia, solo flight. And she took the planes to where they were flying to Germany, the RAF. And in a terrible storm, her plane went down, and she was killed. And when they found her, I always loved this, her purse was with her, and she had a tube of bright red lipstick in her purse, and that she wasn't going to give up any part of herself. And so Annie has had those battles fought. She is successful. She is in the Navy. She is flying a combat plane. She's got every gift but happiness. And how does she find that? So the novel's journey, as soon as I say to you, this is a young girl whose wizard of a father drops her off at a farmhouse in a town called Emerald and says, stay with your aunt and uncle and go look in the barn. There's a gift for you. And she goes into the barn and there's this beautiful red airplane with a single propeller. And he leaves her and she crawls under the wing of the plane and says, I'm a flyer. And when we meet her again, it's 20 years later, this father has disappeared like a wizard, and she's been raised by this Aunt Sam and Uncle Clark. And she comes home for her birthday, and there's a message from her father. Meet me in St. Louis. Bring the plane. Bring your cap with the beaded letters spelling Annie. Come fast. Help me. I need your help. And her first response is, forget it. I'm not going to do it. I'm right to be so angry. My dad was a psychiatrist, and one of the wise things he said a lot of not wise things, but one of the wise things he said was, I spent 50 years giving people therapy. You will not believe how consistently they would rather be right than be happy. And so what what Annie needs to learn is, I'm right to be upset about this, but I gotta go. Why do I have to go? I have to go. I feel I have to go to St. Louis. Love calls her there. And that she goes, even though there's a twister going on. And her little dog, Malpractice, jumps into playing with her and goes. By now, you know where you are. You know what the story is. She's going to find her wizard of a father because he has the answer to the identity of her mother. She doesn't know who her mother was. Is her mother a good witch or a bad witch? What is the name of her mother? That's the question. He wrote on the birth certificate, Claudette Colbert. So that's all the chapter titles are from Claudette Colbert movies. It happened one night. The Palm Beach story. But she's figured out, not likely, that Claudette Colbert was her mother. And so she thinks she's only going to get this answer. She's meeting along the way, and I'm not going to tell you who they are because you read the book and we'll meet them, a scarecrow, a tin man, and a cowardly lion. Who are they? Who are they going to be in her life? Which one is going to be the one? How are the others going to be a part of this great adventure? Because the novel is also a treasure hunt. It's the search for the dream. In this case, a gold statue made of Inca gold and Spanish gold work. Emeralized diamonds. Is it real? Is it fake? What's the meaning of that Pachamama, that Virgin Mary, that mother that she's in search of, that her dad says, you're going to find it, you're going to be queen of the world, it's worth $1 million. Is it or not? And so the book moves Annie to Havana, where she's asked three questions. The last question is, what is the name of her mother? And the whole novel is to bring her to answer that question, the true answer to that question. So it is an emotional, like Raleigh Hayes and Hammond Zinn. It is an emotional journey, but also a comedy. Because the adventures she meets and the people, like the little Cuban guitar playing refugee, I will tell you, we'll give you a clue. He takes a lot of extension courses. He really wants to be educated. And he tries to quote Shakespeare all the time, but he gets it mixed up. And when he finally gets one speech right, it's a speech from The Tempest. And it's a speech from The Tempest because The Tempest is the play of Shakespeare that takes you to the new world and what the Western world did to it. How, and that, I would, the final thing I'll say about this book is that's the journey. If Raleigh Hayes, who goes down the South from Charleston to New Orleans, ends up in New Orleans, is a journey through the racial history of America. This is a journey through the military history. So there are, her uncle is a Vietnam vet. Her first wedding takes place in a Vietnamese restaurant. Her husband is a naval officer. The gold statue was allegedly brought by a U.S. soldier from the Spanish-American War. The fact that it took me 10 years to write this book, and it did. Now, I did other things. You know, I slept, I watched the Red Sox. I wrote First Lady, one of the Hilston books. Red Clay, Blue Cadillac, the short stories, Last Noel, I did not go to write Days of Our Lives, but I did go back to write One Life to Live. But I couldn't lick the problem of this book. And the problem of the book was the narrative had to move fast. I wanted it to move as fast as Annie. It takes place over a week. It's just like this. But I wanted it to loop back to the past, to tell her how she got to be who she was and who the people were who helped create her. And so that was like she was doing loop-de-loops in a play, which I always loved. That there was I read about a woman who flies, still alive, I think, circus pilot. As she got older and older, she always did the number of loop-de-loops of her age. So she was up to 88 loop-de-loops in one go. So this is sort of a psychological loop-de-looping. When you meet Annie Ann and Uncle Henry and The Wizard of Oz, she's gone, and you don't see them again. You never see them until the end when she comes back. In this book, you go back to see them all the time. And that is, in a way, when I've been thinking about it, talking about it, everybody is very interested now to read novels set in Iraq, set in Iran, set in some foreign world where we can, The Kite Runner, where we can open our hearts to the other, which is what novels let you do. They let you enlarge so that you start looking and listening, which most people don't do, to the other. This person may not be like me in some ways, but let me see who this person is. This novel is asking you to look at America like that, to look at your own nation as being filled with people who may be different, who may not share your politics or your your aesthetic, but they do share your humanness. So that as Annie meets people, she starts to look at them. And she never had before. She'd just never seen them. Just, you know, shooting 1,200 miles an hour, she'd never seen them. And so, or how they talk to each other. So there's a lot of, how do you talk? Do you talk in the language of movies? Her Aunt Sam communicates by saying, "Are you talking to me?" Or, "Hey, I'm walking here," or, "We have a problem, Houston," or whatever, talking in movie talk. people talk, and or they don't talk, or they can't connect. And maybe your cowardice is not physical, but it's that you can't connect. So all of that is as true of our fellow Americans as it is of people in Afghanistan. Which brings me to the last thing I'll say was, I love this cover, and I love the Dorothy dress, but the modernness, the blue sky, but I had asked them to change the color of the field to a lime green, which is more the North Carolina, Virginia kind of spring color, and they said, couldn't I see that the gold was the gold of the treasure that she's looking for, the golden statue, and the classic gold of the open American field? And then it happened to be Obama's infomercial. Do you remember that night he did that hour infomercial? And it ended with amber waves of grain. It ended, and I thought, okay, you know, stick with that. And so we left the cover that way. But this novel is like the novel Handling Sin, or like Fool's Cap, which I don't know if any of you have read, but it's about a theater professor who stands on the wings of life, and he won't step onto the stage. And that's the journey that he's hauled through. Really is a journey of we only have one life to live. Or life is not a rehearsal. This is it, guys. This is the play. And many people spend their lives as if it were rehearsing what was going to come. So that as that character, Theo, finally stands on the stage, so Annie moves into the center of a puzzle that is may just look like an empty blue, but it's all the colors of all the people in her life. So, and in a way, it's another Southern journey. This is one thing we talked about in the blogging about, is there a Southern fiction? Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. It's the, what I was saying on this Elizabeth's blog is it's the big river of American literature. And it is because it holds the heart of our history. Alan Gurganus, whom some of you know, I'm sure, his books like Oldest Living Confederate Widow, and I performed The Duke and the King from Huckleberry Finn to a large group studying the global South, and they had asked us to come in there and talk to them about the global South, and we said we don't want to talk about it, but how about if we put a show on for you? And here's the, you know the con artists, the Duke and the King that come on the raft, and they go into the town and put on these fake plays and rip off everybody in the town, and then they're on to the next thing. But in the midst of that, in the midst of that is Jim sitting there on that raft. And saying, I don't know, are we going to have more than one king on this raft? Because one's about all I can stand. And don't you ever wish, Huck, there's a country where there wasn't any kings? Wouldn't that be something to think of? Now, that's the heart of American literature. And in a way, and I hadn't thought about this, and I'll stop and if you have any questions. I'm always saying the comedy says yes. That's what comedy says yes to life. And it's always irritated me in an uncomic way that it's put below the no novel. You know, you don't have a shelf saying great tragic novels like Moby Dick. But you do say, what a wonderful comic novel. I've heard it all my career. And yes somehow seems less large than no. Now, no, Moby Dick says no. He says no. You know, he ends up strapped to a whale. It's funny, and I hadn't thought about it. Huck Finn says no, and yes. No, I'll go to hell before I'll give him a yes. Comedy, this is funny. And so, in this novel, where Annie's most comic adventures take place are on the edge of the grave, right beside an old people's home where people are dying, at a funeral that she thinks is her father's funeral. Oh, I'm sorry to give it away that it's not, but that it's not makes it very funny. She's going, what? How can these be relative? They don't look anything like anybody. Yeah. So, but comedy always is on the foot is slipping into the dirt of the grave, and you skate away like Charlie Chaplin. So, and do you know that movie where he just one of my favorite moments in American film? He's put on skates in a department store, and he's on the second floor. There's no rail. It's like right here. There's no rail. And he just skates out on one foot, so his other leg is out over air. And it's the perfection of what comedy is. And on that perfect note, I have a perfect comedian who was there's a famous story about him that he he was at a party once, and somebody said something about Caruso, and he burst into this exquisite aria. Chaplin, just an extraordinary, like Nessun Dorma from Tosca. People just went, "Oh my God, we didn't know you were an operatic tenor. We didn't know you could sing." And he said, "I can't sing. I was imitating Caruso." Well, that's what art does. Thank you very much, everybody. And ask away. Any questions? Now I've told you a lot of the
plots. Oh, well, I still have to read for the little bits, the bits and pieces.
You should read for story. You should turn the pages for the story. You want to know what happens next. That's the heart of what fiction is. But with a good book, you can read it over and over and over and over, and the story will just get rich. It's not a surprise to anybody what happens to Ahab and Moby Dick. I mean, it might be a surprise to some people, but that's not why anybody is reading Moby Dick again. Oh my God, is he really going to get harpooned? Or Hester, oh no. Put a scarlet A on her. When I was in the seventh grade, our teacher taught us that whole book and never told us what the A stood for, and nobody had a clue. But it didn't. Seemed like a good grade, you know? So.
Over the years, as you've been writing, have you noticed that readers' interest in comedy or sense of humor or what they find comedic has changed over the years that you've been writing? And
yes.
Have you had to adapt for that, or do you just stick with what you have always thought were as fun?
I think you can't. If you try to... My classic example was, I thought, okay, I'll try to earn some money by writing really sleazy stuff. And I sent a story once to a magazine called Hustler. I don't even know if it's still around. And they sent me back a very polite note saying, "Why don't you try the Atlantic Monthly?" So I don't think you can. That you do what you do. But comedy's changed. It's become very aware. There's a lot of satire, conscious parody of pre-existing. You know, modern films are very aware of all the films that went before in a way that the films that went before necessarily weren't. And literary comedy is the same. I notice it's self-consciousness more. Another shift is the distance, the remoteness that is from the character. So that it's fascinating to me that the word, I mean, we've talked about this, the word sentimental, which used to be a positive word, to be sentimental, to have sentiment, meant to have empathy, to be human. Then overly sentimental became a criticism. Now the word sentimental itself is a criticism. You know, oh, that's sentimental. So I think, however, that I teach a course at Duke called America Dreams, American Movies, and it's about classic American films and what do they tell you about America and what do they tell you about us, why did we choose them. These Duke undergraduates are very, very bright but not knowledgeable of these films. I thought, okay, what's going to happen? Charlie Chaplin, what's going to happen? So we put the Gold Rush on. And all of a sudden, I hear the light starting to land, and then the bear's chasing him around the edge of the stuff, and then they're just laughing. And they picked. It happened one night. The Claudette Colbert Clark Gable movie is one of their favorites. So, in a way, I think that Dickens is on PBS now. a serial little Dorrit. People like it. It's very, very cinema. It's very, very classic comedy. It's not Stephen Colbert. On the other hand, there's something marvelous and brilliant to me that in the complete failure of the American press to tell the truth about what was going on with this country the last 8 years, comedy stepped up. When no one else would, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and people like that, satirists, ironists, Will Ferrell, those people stood up. And so to me, one of the great moments of heroism in our political history is an odd moment when Stephen Colbert gave the White House press address, and no one laughed through his whole speech. Those press people just sat there because they were so sold out, they couldn't laugh. They were scared to laugh, you know, because the powers were sitting there. And he just valiantly carried on, thinking total failure. No one's laughing. By midnight, millions of hits all over the world of mostly young people, new generation, saying, wow, he nailed it, you know. And that changed the way the news was being presented. That shifted. So you're going to Jon Stewart, a comedy show, to get your news. So we don't remember Brinkley and Severi really being hilariously funny. But we did, or Walter Cronkite, but we did believe them. We did think they were telling us the truth. And we trusted them. Anybody else?
I just wanted to share something with you. Mm-hmm. I've taught fiction, short fiction at UVA and a small high school, tandem friend school, and I taught your story, Fast Love, which young people always love because it's, you know, about what they're interested in. But always, what I always admired was the way the satire was of the small town in North Carolina was, you know, handled well, and also satirized, and something that people don't talk about much, but the father in that story always wanted his son to become a football player, and instead he became a chess player and a debater, and his rival at the car lot. Yeah, it's very interesting. Because when you told that anecdote about your daughter wanting to join the Navy, yes, I have two daughters.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, it was really well done. Because it's not, and my high school students only taught 2 years, but I taught seniors, and they always picked up on that. Mm-hmm. And the artistic ones always said, "Yeah, my dad wanted me to," and then the other way, the sports ones, "Oh, my dad wanted me to be a photographer," and usually the male.
Well, what I realized when you said that, I never thought of it. See, you come to these things and you learn that the predecessor to Annie, the heroine of this book, is the young woman in that book. The fast runner. She runs. And I forgot. I have forgotten about that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Now go back and
read that again.
Maureen caught me. I was upstairs laughing my head off, and she said, "What are you laughing about?" And I said, "I'm reading Foolscap because I have to give a talk to university librarians, and they will know this book, and I haven't read it 25 years, and I'll sound like a fool. I won't know the story." And so as I started out reading it, I was saying, "This is hilarious. I'm having a wonderful time." And it made me think that it may be just as you grow older, because there's a wonderful story of Faulkner sitting in the lobby of Random House, falling out of his chair, laughing. And Bennett Cerf walking by saying, "Are you okay?" And he said, "It's just the Hamlet. It's just a laugh a minute." And no memory of it at all. That's one of the pleasures of losing your memory. Everything is new. Well, thank you all. If you have a book, I'm happy to sign it for you, or sign your arm.